We most heartily welcome our many guests from the Naval Reserve. It's indeed a pleasure to see you, and we welcome you here. Before announcing the presenting our speaker, I'd like to announce the program for next week and bring to your attention the fact that it will be held on Wednesday instead of Friday. Be held on Wednesday, November 23rd, because of Thanksgiving. Our speaker will be Thomas L. Pitts, Secretary-Treasurer of the California Labor Federation, and his subject is Labor Legislative Program. The morning press and the newspaper releases of the last few days surely indicate the timeliness of our subject today, and your presence here shows the prominence of our speaker. He served 3 years with the Office of Strategic Service in the World War II. He landed with the 1st Army in Normandy in June 1940. He served as GI 2 briefing officer for General Bradley until VE Day. And at the end of World War in Europe, he was a major, had earned 5 battle stars, had been awarded 3 medals of honor, and in 1945 became an editor in the World Report magazine. Since 1947, however, he left that institution, that magazine, to assist in organizing Central Intelligence. So for some 18 years, he's been engaged in that work. They are changing the nature of that work from one of, shall we say, seasonal or temporary employment to one of a career. And I'm sure that we all welcome the opportunity to hear our speaker this day, Lyman B. Kirkpatrick, who is Inspector General of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Gentlemen of the Commonwealth Club, members of the Naval Reserve Association, it's indeed a great pleasure to be here in San Francisco today to speak to you on a subject of such importance and interest as the communist threat in Latin America and Cuba. On the 4th of September, 1821, Secretary of State John Quincy Adams informed the Minister of Russia, quote, that we should contest the right of Russia to any territorial establishment on this continent, and that we should assume distinctly the principle that the American continents are no longer subject for any new European colonial establishments, unquote. On the 2nd of December, 1823, President Monroe enunciated this historic doctrine in his annual message to the Congress. Never since the enunciation of the Monroe Doctrine has such a serious threat to the integrity of the Americas been posed as stems today from that same power which seeks to colonize the world under the name of communism. On an ever-increasing scale since World War II, the communists have intensified their activities in Latin America. These activities include efforts to expand their so-called diplomatic installations. Many trade delegations from bloc countries have visited the area. There have been cultural missions. Opportunities for Latins to have all-expense trips to communist countries have become increasingly numerous. Propaganda has increased, and the silent war of subversion has been expanded on a broad scale through a multitude of front organizations. Espionage has been stepped up over the entire continent. Now, to place the communist activity in proper focus, let us look first at what is happening to the South. In recent years, Latin America has been undergoing rapid social and economic changes. In nearly every country, there are ambitious plans for industrial development and greater diversification of the sources of income. Attempts are being made to establish local sources of essential revenue and for the production of consumer and industrial goods. Drives are in progress to broaden the range of exportable products so as to stabilize and increase income from international trade. The efforts for industrialization have created a series of economic crises. Import costs have run ahead of the earnings of coffee, sugar, copper, and tin exports in competitive world markets, where other sources of supply and new products have had important effects on the sale of commodities from Latin America. Governments have borrowed heavily and issued more money, causing severe inflation. There is a soaring population. Between 1920 and 1960, the population of Latin America increased some 100%, from 90 million to over 180 million. As the population rose, there was a mass migration into the cities, where now more than a quarter of the entire population of Latin America live. Industry has been unable to absorb this flow of migrants into the cities. Many of the peoples flooding into the cities are poor and illiterate, whose hopes of economic betterment are disappointed, and who become easy prey to the communists. People who have lived in conditions little changed over generations find themselves buffeted by forces they have never experienced before. For them, the communists have answers that seem plausible. To take advantage of this situation, the economic and diplomatic strength of the Soviet bloc is being employed consciously and aggressively to supplement the activities of the national communist parties, the international fronts, and the communist intelligence services. The objective is to create and maintain an environment in which homegrown communist revolutions can thrive and be protected. Spearhead of the communist offensive has been the diplomatic installation and delegation. Following the technique of the proverbial camel in the tent, bloc delegations have traveled extensively wherever permitted. From a few hundred representatives in three countries a few years ago, the Soviets alone have increased their official representation by opening an embassy in Havana, and have sent scores of technicians to assist the Castro government. The satellite countries are also contributing to this effort, and Red China is also getting into the act. The extension of communist diplomatic and trade representation in the Southern Hemisphere may not seem significant in itself, but many of these representatives play a key role in the pattern of conquest. The direction for Communist Party work in Latin America stems from the foreign section, or the International Department, of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Through area specialists, the foreign section provides detailed advice and guidance to the national Communist Parties of Latin America. Under a fairly recent directive, the foreign section was told to achieve greater interchange between the various national parties, including mutual support for each other. The peace movement was to be stepped up, and the anti-American campaign spread. Now, to make this effective, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union has expanded its efforts to brief foreign communists, especially since the worldwide confusion in the red ranks that followed the Khrushchev speech in 1956, in which he denounced the atrocities of the Stalin regime. For example, the anti-party purge in 1957 was carefully explained to Latin American communists before it was ever made public. The communist missions in South America handle a number of administrative items for the work of the party. Documents, reports, and messages from the national parties are forwarded to Moscow. Arrangements are made for the travel of the trustworthy and the loyal, and for candidates for conversion to the USSR for enrollment and training establishments, as delegates to May Day meetings or other communist important events, or for vacations or medical treatment. And far from least, the missions provide funds to pay the salaries of the national communist parties and for other party expenses. Now, an important aspect of the work of the communist missions has been to make exciting trade offers following a planned campaign for a permanent growth in economic relations. A particular effort has been made to buy such items as Cuban sugar, Brazilian coffee, and Uruguayan wool. The USSR will purchase at least 5 million tons of Cuban sugar, some 17% of total production, over the next 5 years. If the United States decides not to purchase any part of the new crop, this figure will probably go far higher. The USSR purchases wool and delivers oil to Uruguay, constituting a very major segment of their international trade. In February 1960, Cuba accepted $100 million in economic credit for the Soviet Union, the credit to be used to obtain agricultural and other mechanical instruments. Part of it has also been used to buy weapons. Argentina accepted a similar amount of credit. Mexico turned it down. Bolivia has recently received a very astutely timed offer of a tin smelter from the USSR. Now, in addition to the USSR, the Eastern European satellites maintain highly diversified commercial contacts throughout the hemisphere. The Chinese communists are aggressively trying to expand their trade. They bought a share in Cuba with a purchase of 50,000 tons of sugar in December 59. Chinese also purchased 10,500 tons of nitrate from Chile. It has not been purely coincidental that with this aggressive trade program, there has been substantial gains in the ability of the communist parties to operate in Latin America. In 1954, the Communist Party was legal in only 5 of the 20 republics. Today it is legal in 9. Further, although the party is illegal in other countries, exiled communists have returned to reorganize the party and to establish front organizations. In those few countries where the party has been stringently repressed, the underground cadre has been assisted by communists from adjoining countries. Regardless of the official status of the party, in all of the larger countries, the communists have been able to publish newspapers, theoretical journals, and issue propaganda leaflets. Front organizations were formed and operate in most areas with relative freedom. Literature from the bloc is available from overt outlets, some through the embassies, some through the usual bookstores, or from cultural centers. It is significant to note that there are 250 communist or communist-dominated newspapers and periodicals now being produced in Latin America. The growth of communist activity is indicated by the fact that 18 national parties were represented at the 21st Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in Moscow in 1959. At this time, a special conference for all Latin American delegates was held, at which time instructions were given on the strategy to be followed. Most important item in those instructions given in Moscow in January 1959 was the selection of a base in Latin America for a massive attack on United States policy. This was followed closely by an announcement to the leaders of the Argentine Communist Party that Cuba would become the focal point for all communist activity in the hemisphere. As is well known, in Cuba, the communists have gained control of the government, principally through the efforts of Raul Castro, Ernesto Che Guevara, and Antonio Nunes Jimenez. Guevara has stated publicly that the Cubans aim to export their revolution to the rest of Latin America and every evidence tends to support this. At another important communist meeting in Medellin, Colombia, it was agreed that the Castro regime must be maintained because it is to be the base for the revolutionary movement throughout the area. Now, there's ample confirmation of this in the many organizations formed throughout the continent to support the Cuban Revolution and the key men in these organizations. To mention just three, Federico Belling, a well-known communist, helped organize the Legion of Volunteers for the Defense of Cuba in Peru. Beltran Coba was active in the formation of the Venezuelan Worker Peasant Committee for support of the Cuban Revolution, and a prime mover behind the Colombian Committee for the Defense of the Cuban Revolution was Gilberto Vieira White, the political secretary of the Communist Party in that country. Cuban activity in exporting its current form of revolution has followed the precise Communist Party technique. Following the World Youth Festival in Vienna in 1959, the Communists began preparation for a Latin American Youth Congress. Catholic and other non-Communist youth organizations were induced to support the Congress and to participate in preparatory meetings. However, once underway, the Communists established control over the preparations through well-coordinated support from the Communist parties and youth organizations in the various countries, which had been given orders that this was to be a top priority effort. By the time the Congress was held in July 1960, it was a completely controlled Communist show in which the Cuban Revolution was exploited as the answer to the problems of Latin American youth. A permanent committee was established for a second Latin American Youth Congress to carry on the propaganda and organizational work of the first. In accordance with the communist efforts to support the revolution to export the revolution to other countries, some of the visitors to the Youth Congress were chosen to receive military and sabotage training similar to that given to the Cuba militia. Perhaps some of this schooling is evident in this week's headlines. The military training of other Latin Americans has been underway ever since the early days of the Castro regime. On one occasion last spring, for example, at a meeting of communists in Latin America, three youths were chosen to be sent to Havana for sabotage training. Typical of how this youth organization works is the high school essay contest in Barranquilla, Colombia. The subject, student problems and the Cuban Revolution. The prize, a trip to the next meeting of the Latin American Youth Congress. In another field, a book by Che Guevara entitled Guerrilla Warfare is receiving wide circulation in subversive circles throughout the hemisphere. Other interesting documents, such as 150 questions for a guerrilla fighter and a handbook on the use of explosives, are also being widely spread. An important instrument in propagating the philosophy of the Cuban Revolution has been the Agencia Prensa Latina, a so-called news service exclusively organized for this purpose. The activities of the Cuban emissaries, particularly their generally young, articulate, and aggressive ambassadors around the hemisphere, are being increasingly revealed in their true light. Like their communist masters, the Cubans are showing increasing disregard for the norms of international conduct. We might say that perhaps the Cubans are not their own masters in this regard, for it was the Soviet embassy that gave the instructions to a university youth organization on the reception to be given President Torticos when he went to Mexico. One interesting aspect of the Cuban campaign of subversion is their disregard of their collaborators. Despite Castro's repeated insistence that he is against dictators, they are affording active support to the followers of Perón in Argentina, and a frequent visitor to Cuba has been John William Cook, the chief of Perón's underground in Buenos Aires. There have been other interesting visits to Cuba. On the 6th of May, 1 hour after his release from prison in Mexico City, Raymond Mercader, also known as Jacques Bornard, the assassin of Trotsky, boarded a Cuban airline plane for Havana. He was traveling on a Czech passport. Now, not all of the visitors to Cuba have been of this ilk. The Castro regime has made an intensive effort to attract people to come to Havana and see what the revolution looks like. In Havana, in Cuba, the facade of communism is all very proper. The casual visitor sees the usual activities in the beautiful city, where all seems much the same. The trains run. There are no signs on them that they have been expropriated by the government. Sugarcane grows in the fields. No labels indicate that it's being used as a form of communist blackmail. Children continue to go to school. These innocents are little aware that their basic lesson today is in class hatred, warfare. And the university is open and is used as a major center for communist subversion. Yes, the face of communism smiles, while behind the scenes the evil work continues. Catherine the Great had her Potemkin village. Today we have the two faces of communism. Now, among the most important elements of that hidden face of communism is the work of the front organizations, which today are active over the entire continent. Recognizing the importance of labor in the growing industrialization in Latin America, the communists have made an intensive drive in the trade unions. Spearhead of this offensive has been the World Federation of Trade Unions, its program to cooperate with and use any nationalist forces, to organize campaigns against those government officials who cannot be controlled, to organize the peasants, to place the blame for any trouble on foreign businessmen. Frequent visits by European communists coordinate and direct the WFTU activities in South America, where schools for labor have been run to train the young labor leaders. Now, of all the communist fronts, none is more insidious than the World Peace Council and its peace partisan committees. The mission of the communist movement today is to exploit the fear of war and to exploit the non-communist and anti-communist to take advantage of the anti-nuclear weapon campaign. Now, please understand that there are undoubtedly many peace-loving persons in these movements, but they would do well to look closely at their colleagues and to carefully examine some of the sources of drive in these organizations. In no other front organization is the utter cynicism, opportunism, and deceit of the communists so evident. To lend respectability to its peace partisan committees, the self-avowed atheistic and materialistic communist movement, by deliberate directive, attempts to recruit patriotic priests and representatives of various religious faiths. The communists in the peace campaign accept neutralism as an ally. However, any criticism of the bloc as a possible source of world tension or the Cold War is strictly forbidden. In fact, the communists are extremely sensitive to the criticism that the peace movement is a tactic. Yet Stalin, at the 19th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, went so far as to point out to the party faithful that the peace movement would not directly bring about the universal victory of communism, even though it would make a useful contribution to the seizure of power. The intensification of the peace drive in Latin America led to the return in 1958 of such key communists as Lobo Carneiro of Brazil and Alfredo Varela of Argentina from the Secretariat of the World Peace Council in Vienna. Key target of the communist efforts in Latin America, as elsewhere in the world, has been the young people of the area. The immediate efforts of the Cubans to establish a hemispheric youth organization is indicative of its high priority. In their approach to Latin America, the communists are using the World Federation of Democratic Youth and the International Union of Students as organizational weapons. Ever since the early 50s, these organizations have conducted intensive drives throughout Latin America, gaining many new affiliates, with memberships now approaching an overall total of 700,000. Both organizations have concentrated on building up large cadres of leaders in each specialized field of youth and student organizational work. Special training has been given to organizing strikes and demonstrations. Formal 1 to 3 month courses are conducted on such subjects as agronomy and the mechanization of agriculture. Youth leader seminars are held in each branch of sport, for young workers by trade, for peasant girls by region. In keeping with the increased attention on Latin America by all communist organizations, was the action of the Congress of International Union of Students in Peking in September 1958. The Ecuadorian communist Jorge Galarza participated as a delegate. The Congress of the Union of Students had never before paid much attention to Latin America. On this occasion, 12 national organizations were represented from 16 Latin American countries. The Congress adopted 8 resolutions dealing with the area, a striking departure from its previous slight regard. The headquarters of the World Federation of Democratic Youth in Budapest recently gave instructions to its regional commissioner for Latin America to pay particular attention to youth in the West Indies. It has also been tightening up the liaison procedures for working with the national communist parties, and more youth leaders have been taken to Budapest and Prague for training. To the communists, a particular important feature of their youth program has been their biennial World Youth Festival. The fifth festival in Warsaw in 1955 and the sixth in Moscow in 1957 were attended by over 1,000 students from Latin America. But with orders for increased participation from the area, Otto Cesar Vargas Garretti, the organizational leader for Latin America, was able to get 1,380 to attend the 7th Congress in Vienna in 1959. The effort put into these massive productions is well illustrated by the fact that the travel to Moscow for the Latin American delegates cost $932,000, of which only $60,000 came from Latin America itself. Now, these are but illustrative of the major front activities. Increasingly important is the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, which has a center in Rio and has a record of close and effective cooperation with the World Peace Council. This is indicative of the communist effort to organize the professions, as well as the students, as well as the trade unions. The International Organization of Journalists works with the bloc news agencies from the Soviet Union, from Cuba, from Czechoslovakia, and more recently, Peking's New China News Agency, the forerunner of a massive Chinese effort on the continent. The list could be expanded indefinitely, but it's particularly important to watch the efforts of the Chinese in this regard. The NCNA, New China News Agency, is always a forerunner of Chinese aggression. It is one of their basic installations from which they conduct all types of activities in support of communist organization. The objective of this tremendous effort by the communists in Latin America is the one which they have never disavowed and never changed: communization of each and every country. To do this, they will attempt to destroy the democratic principles on which these republics are based. They will ruthlessly and subtly try to undermine the influence of the church, and they will attack everything connected with the United States as constituting an obstacle to their avowed conquest. They will endeavor to create opposition to the Inter-American Defense Board, to the U.S. defense pacts, and to the military assistance groups. Strenuous efforts will be made to stir up opposition to U.S. business interests. In fact, the Brazilian Communist Party adopted a program to develop relations with businessmen by encouraging all those who dislike foreign competition to assist the communist effort. On the other hand, the massive effort by the communists directed at Latin America is basically a minority movement, albeit a very dangerous one. Any effort to combat this movement must be armed with precise and accurate knowledge of what they are trying to do, how they're trying to do it, and what they're trying to do it with. Understanding of the basic conditions that help to create communist sympathizers is of major importance. We should exercise self-restraint and care in judging individuals, movements, and governments. An emotional preoccupation with or an overestimation of the capabilities of the communists can only hamper our efforts. The United States has tens of millions of friends in Latin America, and they look to us as friends in this struggle. Thank you very much.
Before I introduce back for the question and answer period, the speaker who has so eloquently presented the problems of the day and the relationship of our way of life to the communistic way, I would like to introduce to you the man who is sitting at the head table, not listed because we didn't realize that we were to be honored with his presence today, but he is the Secretary of the Navy for Reserves, Richard Jackson. Would you stand, please, for a bow? Now, I sometimes take advantage of an opportunity, Mr. Kirkpatrick, after such a sobering address as you have given us, for a somewhat of a mental seventh-inning stretch. We have a local problem, probably presented very concretely in this fashion. Can CIA please advise who's got the axe?
Mr. Graybill, you are aware, of course, that we are enjoined by law from any activities within the United States. However, I would simply give those ardent searchers for the axe this clue. There was a great deal of activity in the Palace Hotel last night. There's something very lumpy under my mattress.
Room number on request. Now we have two or three questions here. I got to say, a couple of these concern a Stanford professor, and just because I'm an old blue don't mean I'm not shooting at anybody. This just because Saturday's a big game. I recently heard a local college professor state, Fidel Castro is one of the great men of this century. I wish more countries had more Castros. I consider him one of the most brilliant men I have ever met, end of quotes. Will you please comment? And then this goes ahead to say the Stanford University professor Paul Baran 2 nights ago stated such and such. I make no accusation of the accuracy of the authorship.
It may well be that Fidel Castro is one of the most brilliant men of his time. Facts nevertheless remain that the Cuban government is run by the communists. Whether Castro himself intended or not, it to become a tool of the communist organization. It has become a tool of the communist organization. Perhaps his brilliance didn't extend to keeping the communists from taking over. But I think it can truly be said that they have taken over Cuba, regardless of Castro's brilliance.
This question, Professor Hilton of Stanford appears to believe that a training base in Guatemala is financed by the United States for an attack on Castro. He says, if CIA is behind this and gets caught, it will be a black day for the United States. Will you please comment?
It's always a black day for the United States when CIA gets caught.
Now, two or three questions deal with this whole philosophy of the position of Cuba and the Monroe Doctrine, which, may I tell our guests here today, the International Relations section of the Commonwealth Club has undertaken a review of the Monroe Doctrine under modern circumstances, and after about a year's intensive study, a report will be issued to the members of Commonwealth. Cuba has, in fact, become a Soviet satellite. The Monroe Doctrine excludes colonization by European despots. Why don't we take immediate action to destroy Castro? Now, in connection with the application of the Monroe Doctrine, we have two or three questions that deal with the philosophy of whether or not our insistence upon Monroe Doctrine for the Latin Americas may be in conflict today, or may have some parallel in Russia's right to insist that we take no part, military bases or otherwise, either on the continent of Asia or Europe. Would you like to comment on that in your own thinking?
One of the basic precepts in intelligence is to maintain a clear distinction between intelligence and policy. Our requirement is to keep the United States government policymakers informed of what's going on abroad. Consequently, we're very reluctant to make any comments which, by inference or otherwise, would seem to be a recommendation for U.S. policy. I would comment on this regard. I think that we must recognize that not just Latin America, but the entire world is watching very closely everything this government does, says, or indicates about the Castro regime. Consequently, the action which we can take should be very carefully designed, because I believe you may have recognized in the brief discussion that I had with you on the communist efforts that a tremendous part of their goal is directed towards the men, the minds of the men. And consequently, in this area, moral leadership assumes tremendous importance. Now, obviously, I am talking around the point as far as our action is concerned, but I do wish that the many of us who become impatient at our occasionally having to stand and turn the other cheek would recognize that long-term policies often pay off in greater measure than short-term expediencies.
Thank you. I think you've defined entirely the difference in the operations of the CIA. This question: American tourists in Mexico report an apparently increased number of Orientals in that country. Are the Chinese communists increasingly infiltrating Mexico?
I can't answer that question specifically as to whether there's been any marked increase in Chinese moving into Mexico. This has been a general pattern over recent years. There has been a flow of the refugees from Hong Kong who try to get to South America. Some of these are obviously legitimate refugees, and others are not. I would not be at all surprised if there was a marked movement by the Chinese communists into Mexico, as into all other South American countries.
How would you care to comment comparatively on this question? Are intelligent activities second to none, or has Russia closed the gap?
Well, I obviously would be unaware of any gap. But with all due humility, we feel that our intelligence activities are good and getting better. We do not underestimate the extremely capable opposition presented to us by the Soviets and the other communist intelligence services. They're far larger than we are numerically. They devote more time to it. But I think that the United States has no reason to be ashamed of its intelligence services.
In a number of recent addresses before Commonwealth, the recurring question has come up from our audiences with respect to China and Russia, competition or cooperation extending the communist pattern throughout the world. Can we expect cooperation or competition between Russia and China in their Latin American operations?
We can expect cooperation. I don't think anybody should mislead themselves at these ideological differences which are debated in the various congresses of high communists in any way will lessen their cooperation in their mutual efforts to communize the world.
Would you take a minute now to discuss the current role of the American Communist Party in Soviet espionage?
I would have to say there that this is a subject on which the Federal Bureau of Investigation is expert, and I quite honestly would say that all I know about it is what I have read in their publications.
I have heard that there is an active communist guerrilla warfare unit in New York State. Is this true? And if it is true, why is it permitted to exist?
The same answer as the previous question. This is a matter for the FBI, and I would think that this is ridiculous.
And now we close with a question that has been before this club from time to time. Are unidentified flying objects, such as flying saucers, of any current concern?
Do what you want with it.
Gentlemen, we have enough to do worrying about the flying objects on the surface without worrying about those in outer space.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kirkpatrick. The meeting's adjourned.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across the microphone from me sits Lyman B. Kirkpatrick, Inspector General of the United States Central Intelligence Agency. Inspector Kirkpatrick just spoke before the weekly general meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here in the Sheraton Palace Hotel, San Francisco, on the topic, the Communist Threat in the Americas and Cuba. Inspector Kirkpatrick, you opened by recalling to our mind that it was in 1821 that John Quincy Adams informed the Minister of Russia that we should contest the right of Russia to any territorial establishment on this continent. The situation then was up by the northwest corner of what is now the United States, and Russia was moving down in towards San Francisco. In fact, had been here, as we know. And 2 years later, the Monroe Doctrine was enunciated, which has been used primarily, most of our people think solely, with respect to Latin America. In your talk to the Commonwealth Club today, you brought out the fact that we should first, to be intelligently aware of what we're discussing, take a look down to the south of us. And you said the efforts at industrialization, which we usually think of as a good thing, sir, but you said they have created a series of economic crises. How come, sir?
Well, Mr. Ward, I don't think we ought to assume that industrialization isn't a good thing. But in any industrial revolution, there are bound to be problems. In Latin America, for example, the import costs have run ahead of earnings of such things as coffee, sugar, copper, and tin in the competitive world markets, where other sources of supply and new products have had important effects on the sale of commodities from Latin America. The governments have borrowed heavily and issued more money, resulting in inflation. There's been a soaring population, and between 1920 and 1960, a gain of some 100% from the 90 million to over 180 million people living in the area. As the population rose, there's a mass migration into the cities, where now more than a quarter of the people of Latin America live. Industry has been unable to absorb the flow of migrants into the cities. Many of the people flooding the cities are poor and illiterate, whose hopes of economic betterment are disappointed and who are easy prey to the communists. People who've lived in conditions little changed over generations find themselves buffeted by forces they have never experienced before. For them, the communists have answers that seem plausible.
Reminded of what was said by the man who was the witness, Whitaker Chambers, who said that when people in all countries are confused and aware of problems sociological, he said this evil thing, communists, lies at the entrance, waiting to take them over and say, this is the answer. You went on, Inspector, to say that the communist offensive spearhead had been the diplomatic corps. I remember that in the days of the Nazis in Mexico, that they had 250 agents at the Nazi headquarters, the embassy from Nazi Germany. We commented on it at that time. I understand that more recently there have been two or three times that number at an embassy in Mexico of the communists. They took over the theater there in Mexico City on an eight-year long-term lease, and they have carried on many other activities aided and abetted by such people as Diego Rivera, now deceased, and some others. What is the general picture? Is that a general picture of what the Russian diplomatic service does, sir?
I think that's quite an accurate picture. For example, from a few hundred representatives in three countries a few years ago in South America, the Soviets have increased their official representation by opening an embassy in Havana, had sent scores of technicians to assist the Castro government. The extension of communist diplomatic and trade representation in the Southern Hemisphere may not seem significant in itself, but many of these representatives play a key role in the pattern of conquest.
Back in 1880, sir, we recall that the Kaiser was playing the game of claiming all of Brazil because it had been hypothecated to the Fugas firm of silversmiths that made a loan to the King of Brazil, the King of Portugal, in Brazil at that time. And subsequently, Hitler took over and made active efforts with thousands and tens of thousands of technicians and experts to take over, and as we know, in Chile and in a lower part of Argentina and Peru and other places, also in Brazil. There was a lot of anti-American sentiment spread by the Kaiser's activities, by Hitler's activities. Is there anything of that sort going on now?
Yes, the communists are making a major effort to spread anti-American sentiment throughout the continent. The communist missions in South America are the major spearhead for this particular effort. They work with the local communist parties. They work with the various front organizations which the communists have established for this particular effort. And they work, of course, with the intelligence services of the communist bloc.
Hedy Massing, the former active communist agent for many years in the United States, who had at one time $100,000 in Russian gold in a New York bank and that sort of thing, when she became a loyal American citizen, testified that a certain individual in our State Department had been going to a parked automobile in Washington, D.C. every 2 weeks and divulging the State Department secrets and activities and plans for Latin America, which we were then carrying on. Is that sort of thing done now by Americans, or is it handled in any other way, Inspector?
Well, we're talking primarily, of course, of what's going on in Latin America. And in Latin America, their primary effort is through the local indigenous population. They, of course, do handle it in certain instances with representatives out of their diplomatic installations. This generally, however, is not a very approved technique for operation.
Well, now we're endeavoring to lower an economic embargo on Cuba. Has there been any, shall I say, response in the way of counteractivity on the part of communist Russia, sir?
There's been a major response on the part of the communists as far as Cuba is concerned. You will note that they've made a particular effort to buy up Cuban sugar. The USSR has announced it'll purchase at least 5 million tons of Cuban sugar, about 17% of the exports, over the next 5 years. If the United States decides not to purchase any part of the new crop, this figure will probably be far higher. In February 1960, Cuba accepted $100 million in economic aid credit from the Soviet Union, this credit to be used to obtain agricultural and industrial equipment. Part of this has also been spent for arms. This is the general pattern of the economic offensive by the communists in Latin America.
You mentioned to the Commonwealth Club today, Inspector, that Bolivia, with its vast tin mines, had been given a smelter by Russia. In the past, we had smelted that tin in the United States or in England or elsewhere with some Indonesian tin to make it easily flexible, remember. Now, is that sort of thing characteristic not only of Russia, this giving of a tin smelter to Bolivia, or are there activities on the part of other red satellites?
There are activities on the part of other red satellites, but to keep the record straight, I should note that Bolivia has been offered a tin smelter. To our knowledge, they have not yet accepted it.
That's true of a number of the loans, isn't it? I think in Ethiopia and other places, loans have been offered, and also we could make mention of other countries, but they haven't accepted them yet.
That is correct. For example, the Soviets offered Mexico $100 million in economic credit, and the Mexicans turned it down. Now, in answer to your previous question about the other communist powers, the Eastern European satellites have maintained a highly diversified commercial effort throughout the hemisphere, and the Chinese communists have moved in a fairly major way. They bought a share in Cuba with a purchase of 50,000 tons of sugar in December 1959, and they've also purchased 10,500 tons of nitrate from Chile. And in addition to these purchases, of course, all of the communist powers use the technique of low-interest loans or, in certain instances, outright economic aid.
Inspector Lyman B. Kirkpatrick of the Central Intelligence Agency, you told us today that whereas communists formerly had five out of the 20 republics south of the Rio Grande, that today they have nine, that when we lower the boom in the way of forbidding them, or when these countries lower the boom on their legality, they managed to exist illegally. And then you went on to paint the picture, sir, of what the position is of Cuba. As sort of a beachhead, could we call it, for communism?
Yes, I think beachhead's a very apt word. In fact, in the 21st Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in Moscow in 1959, an instruction was given that a base in Latin America for a massive attack on United States policy was to be set up, and this was to be Cuba.
Well, now, you mentioned that Cuba has aimed to export their revolution, as you well put it, sir, to other countries of Latin America, which explains the headlines in newspapers the last several days. How about their drive for youth? It is an axiom of many groups that give us the youth, and we'll take care of the future.
The drive for youth has taken a particularly virulent form in Cuba. Following the World Youth Festival of 1959 in Vienna, the communists began to prepare for a Latin American Youth Congress. Catholic and other non-communist youth organizations were induced to support the Congress and to participate in preparatory meetings. But once underway, the communists established control over the preparations through well-coordinated support from all of the parties and the youth organizations. By the time the Congress was held, it was a completely controlled communist show.
We have known, Inspector, that for many years there has been a Moscow training school, one at Krakow in Poland and other places, designed to train the brightest, the smartest young people of communist trend from all nations in sabotage, in fomentation of revolution, that sort of thing. Did I understand you correctly to say to the club today that they are establishing that sort of a school in Havana and sending in the bright young people from other Latin American countries?
To be quite precise about this, definite indication that a school is being established, such as those that are maintained in some of the prominent cities behind the Iron Curtain, is not yet solid. However, we do know that youth from other countries have gone to Cuba for training in sabotage and guerrilla warfare and the other techniques of communist subversion.
A lot of Americans, sir, have been impressed by this position of Castro, that he's against dictators. Particularly, he was against the dictator in the Dominican Republic, and the Organization of American States got us to combine with them in throwing out economic support of that dictator. Is Castro, is Cuba, are the communist agents consistent in their attitude on this?
They're definitely not consistent, despite Castro's reported denunciation of dictators. They're affording active support to the Peronistas in Argentina. And John William Cook, the chief of Peron's underground in Buenos Aires, has been a visit to Havana.
The foreign agent who smuggled his way into Mexico and drove an alpine stock pick into the head of Leon Trotsky has been dined and wined and kept in a comfortable prison quarters with music and cigars and liquors and all the rest of it for a number of years. He was released only last May, wasn't it? Where did he go after he left here?
On the 6th of May, 1 hour after his release from prison in Mexico City, Ramon Mercado, also known as Jacques Mornard, the slayer of Trotsky, boarded a Cuban airline plane for Havana, traveling on a Czech passport.
We know that Catherine the Great, among her other idiosyncrasies, was famous for having created the Potemkin Village, which was a phony village made out of cardboard and the fronts of wood and that sort of thing, and then sailed a barge down a river from which this could be viewed. Now, how did you tie that in with the two faces of communism, as you call it, Mr. Kirkpatrick?
I'm glad you asked that question, Mr. Ward. To the casual visitor, the facade of communism is all very proper. The casual visitor sees the usual activity in the beautiful city of Havana, where all seems much the same. The trains run, there are no signs on them saying that this railroad has been seized by the government. The sugar cane grows in the fields. No labels indicate that it is being used as economic blackmail by the communists. The children continue to go to school. These innocents are little aware that their basic lesson today is in class warfare and hatred.
Now, Inspector, I'm going to do something I never did before, the one-hour interviewees, because this was so good. Would you mind reading to us your concluding two paragraphs, for they summed up your talk and the objectives so well, sir?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Ward. The objective of this tremendous effort by the communists in Latin America is the one which they have never disavowed, never changed: communization of each and every country. To do this, they will attempt to destroy the democratic principles on which these republics are based. They will ruthlessly and subtly try to undermine the influence of the church, and they will attack everything connected with the United States as constituting an obstacle to their avowed conquest. They will endeavor to create opposition to the Inter-American Defense Board, to the U.S. Defense Pacts, and to the military assistance groups. Strenuous efforts will be made to stir up opposition to U.S. business interests. In fact, the Brazilian Communist Party adopted a program to develop relations with businessmen by encouraging all those who dislike foreign competition to join the communist effort. On the other hand, the massive effort by the communists directed at Latin America is basically a minority movement, albeit a very dangerous one. Any effort to combat this movement must be armed with precise and accurate knowledge of what it is trying to do, how it is trying to do it, and what it has to work with.
Thank you very much, Inspector, for that interesting talk, for which we give all too little. May I announce that next week at the same time, same station, I'll be interviewing for you the Commonwealth Club of California speaker then, Thomas L. Pitts, Secretary-Treasurer, California Labor Federation, on California's legislative program.